News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
In this special report for News 101, I spoke with activists at the rally.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
But we've come to think that growth is the very definition of progress.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, offering listeners local, national, and international news from a fully independent perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening and welcome to News 101. I'm Brad Pepping and I'm going to be your host for the next hour in this Olympics coverage, what's going on in the city. Today on the program, we have Executive Director of the BCCLA, David Eby, who's going to be speaking to us about the Legal Observer training or Legal Observer program that's been monitoring what's going on in the city, as well as what's been happening in the city with protesters and civil liberties. Also in the station, we have the reporters from the UBCU who have been doing extensive coverage of the games, and we're going to have their opinion and their comments about what's happening with not only protesters but also with their coverage. Lastly, we're going to be jumping to Whistler, and we'll be able to hear from one of our reporters, Kate Hughes, and her opinion about what's going on in Whistler, the atmosphere there, and we'll also be covering the march from the downtown east side to in memory of the missing women of the downtown east side. That's all today on the show. This is News 101, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. First up on the line, I have David Eby, Executive Director of the BCCLA, and David Eby has been speaking with media about what's going on in Vancouver, but he's also helping out with the Legal Observer program. And David, thanks for joining us on the phone. Sure. Hey, David, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first, I was wondering if you could just fill us in on what's going on with the Legal Observers here in Vancouver.
Well, we're really busy. It's been a crazy week. We've had demonstrations starting with the opening ceremonies right through to tonight's Tent City. We have 8 observers that are actually working all night to protect the Tent City and the rights of those who are there and make sure that they're protected legally. And so it's a very busy time for us.
And could you tell us about some of the things that have been happening in the last few days? Have the Legal Observers been downtown reporting about what's happening?
Yeah, the observers have been at a lot of demonstrations. We've been at a lot of Olympic venues and events. Generally speaking, we've been very pleased with the hands-off approach of the police to date in terms of very low police numbers at the Murder of Missing Women Memorial March and very restrained policing there. And in terms of the opening ceremony demonstration where police did not use any crowd control agents or any undue force. There was some pushing and shoving that we didn't like. We didn't like that the RCMP weren't wearing their badge numbers as they should have been. But we thought on the whole that for police and protesters alike, those events were wonderful.
And this weekend, I actually had the chance to catch up with Mayor Robertson, and I asked him his opinion about having these legal observers in Vancouver. I was hoping if you could touch upon just the idea of having legal observers. Is this something, is this new to the Vancouver Olympics? Has it happened in Beijing or Salt Lake City, other places? And do you think that it's something that maybe could continue with the upcoming games in London and so forth?
Yeah, it's a program that's based on a program designed by the National Lawyers Guild in the United States. Based on their materials, but it's a little bit different, and it's designed for the Olympics, and it's the first time we're aware of that independent legal observers have been present at an Olympic Games and monitoring people's rights. Obviously, in Beijing, there was a limited appetite on the part of the government to tolerate that kind of thing going on. But here in Canada, we've had a good opportunity to be out there and monitoring the police, and I think our presence has made a real difference. I think the concerns around civil liberties and rights and freedoms really penetrated the police consciousness, and their reluctance to be caught on tape doing anything untoward, I think it's made a real difference in terms of how they conduct themselves around the Olympics. And I hope that other cities take from this program what they wish, but use it, because it's been very successful here in encouraging the police to act properly.
And so that brings us to what I imagine a lot of Vancouverites and international guests are talking about. There was a march on Saturday, and the march, as many people have already heard, kind of evolved into violence. And so many people have been speculating about what's been happening. I wanted to touch on that with you because there's actually an interview that you had with the Canadian Press where you said the event sickened you. I was hoping if you could just touch upon it and kind of what happened and maybe give us a bit of context about what sickened you.
Yeah, sure. It's, it was incredibly frustrating for us. We're running the Legal Observer program. We were contacted by one of the organizers who asked us not to attend. We had designed the program to be beneficial to demonstrators to make sure that their rights were protected. And so when they called and said, you're not welcome here, we don't want you, we took that seriously. We were like, okay, well, you know, this was to benefit you. And so if you don't want us, we think it's a mistake because you're going to be doing roadblocks and civil disobedience. And we think you're vulnerable to police. But, you know, that's your call and we'll respect that decision. Well, that was a really big mistake. Because we didn't know what was, maybe most of the people in the march didn't know what it was going to evolve into. But now it appears like we weren't there because we were afraid of recording some of the activities the demonstrators got up to and all these sorts of things. So we've had to revise our policies and say that we're going to every demonstration now. But what really upset me about the tactics engaged in by, and it's got to be pointed out, a very small number of people on what was itself a smaller march compared to the thousands of people out for the opening ceremonies and the thousands of people out yesterday for the Murdered and Missing Women march. What really upset me about it was all of the hard work that's been done by all of the activists who are out there peacefully, bringing their message forward, doing a wonderful job of influencing public opinion. And here's a small group within a small group that really has now taken the media spotlight. And has detracted so heavily from the Olympic message that needs to be talked about, which is all this public spending, for example, and the fact that we've got a major homelessness problem. Now we're all talking about violence and protests. Now we're all talking about property destruction, whether it's appropriate or not, when we should be talking about the fact that $1 billion was spent on security, or that, you know, $6 billion was spent on the games. We've got people burning to death in the streets trying to keep warm.
Right. And maybe you could comment about how that reflects on the upcoming events. You mentioned the Tent City protest today and any other events that are scheduled to happen in the next coming days. Do you think that, again, the presence of the BCCLA Legal Observers is to put those protesters at ease to make sure that they understand their rights will be guaranteed during the games, but now that protesters are causing all this violence, do you think that it's going to deter tourists or deter more protests? What, in your opinion, is coming up in these next days?
Yeah, well, I think it should be just emphasized one more time that this is a small group of people and that many of the demonstrators were very peaceful and are doing a wonderful job out there. But I do think that it has an effect in that it I think there was a public climate before that event that the police were overly heavy-handed with demonstrators, that they shouldn't have been buying the LRAD sonic gun, they shouldn't have been following people around, all those things. And an event like that can change, even a few people, even if they're not the people that the police were following around and harassing, has the effect in the public mind saying, well, oh, these people were a security risk, oh, so that the police were proper in doing those things, which they certainly were not, you know? And so I think it has an effect in justifying police conduct that's still inappropriate. I mean, for example, we had police officers visit the building that we're in, push into the back of the, push in is not the correct word, I'm going to rephrase that, walk into the back offices of the W2 Media Center, the tech center, not a public area, with Canadian Border Services agents in tow, and invade that space, which is a space for journalists, and in the same building that the Legal Observer program runs. We ran a press release about it, but all anyone wants to talk about is the demonstration on Saturday. So, you know, police conduct, they're being given more of a free pass on the kinds of things that they're doing as a result of that.
Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. Best of luck in the coming days, and we look forward to speaking with BCCLA on Friday to get an update. What's going on?
Great. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the chance to talk about these things.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
And that was David Eby, BCCLA Executive Director, speaking with us about the Legal Observer program, as well as his comments in the Canadian press about the Saturday violent protest here in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we have Paul Bucci and Trevor Record in the studio from the UBC, the student newspaper, who have prepared some comments about what's going on in the city, as well as some information from the front of their page. That's coming back right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is News 101.
February 23rd, beginning at sunset in Montreal, broadcasting live on your local campus and community radio station.
Sometimes we get that instant homelessness. We didn't expect to be homeless, and we find ourselves on the street because of an eviction or a notice.
Canada's largest talk show on poverty and homelessness.
We have a mayor who compared poor people to pigeons publicly and said that if you stop feeding them, they'll go away.
The 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting February 23rd to 24th. A 14-hour live radio show from frozen street corners across Canada. Call in live, join the discussion.
Our demand from the federal government is $2 billion a year for social housing units across Canada. That'll just help us to start catching up to the 15 years that we've lost in building social housing in this country. It's really a glaring example of the negligence of the government.
Visit www.ckut.ca for more info.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcasting live from Vancouver on Tuesday, February 23rd at 8 p.m. as CITR 101.9 FM partners with CJSF 90.1 FM and Co-op 102.7 FM to bring you an hour of interviews and stories of how the 2010 Olympics are affecting homelessness in Vancouver. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, and in studio, I have Paul Bucci and Trevor Record of the UBC, and they're here to talk about what's going on with their coverage of the Olympic Games. And thank you guys very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. So the Olympics are here, and the UBC is still printing. We have 2 weeks off of school and paper to put out, so we're taking these 2 weeks to just hit the streets. And many other people have been hitting the streets as well, as everyone is well aware. It really started getting going on Thursday when the torch came through UBC. Many students who were both for and against the Olympics came out. Thousands packed the streets for hours across campus, dressed in red and white, waiting for the arrival of the flame. First-year art student Jediah Sabaya said, "It's once-in-a-lifetime thing, and you don't see it on your campus that often." The torch started at West Mall and Thunderbird Boulevard just before 6 p.m. and traveled along Main Mall. The torch was surrounded by a crowd of police officers and watched from the sky by helicopters. The crowd's Olympic supporters cheered. The protesters, however, about 60 strong, booed and waved placards reading, "Corporations off campus and complacency is complicity." Tensions flared between the groups as well. At one point, a group of Olympic supporters ran through the march and shouted, "Go back to Russia," at the protesters. Rumors flew the day before that the protesters were going to try and put out the torch, which attracted the attention of large media outlets such as CTV and CBC. However, it was not to be. On Fridays, police forces and several thousand anti-Olympic protesters met in a tense clash outside of BC Place as the 2010 opening ceremonies kicked off inside the stadium. Estimates of the peak size of the crowd range from 3,000 to 5,000. On Saturday, of course, that is, was the big one, where the violence was in the streets. Windows were broken at the Hudson's Bay store downtown, and newspaper boxes were kicked over and spray-painted. Seven people were arrested. This hasn't stopped any further protesting, however, as there were a couple today and more are planned for the upcoming week. So what do UBC students have to do with this? Trevor Record, the UBC's features and opinions editor, polled students on their opinions about the games. So, Trevor, what was the most significant thing you found?
Oh, I'd find, like, most students actually didn't really have any plans to do anything for the Olympics. I'd say very few had tickets to any sorts of events. But even more surprisingly, just in terms of the number of students that said they were going to watch it on TV, it was only about 57% said they had definite plans to watch the Olympics on TV. Only about 40% said they were going to go to a concert or any sort of free event for sure, which, you know, is kind of surprising considering the number of events that are happening. And a good 20% said they were planning on getting out of town, actually. So I think that more than anything, it wasn't that students were super excited or super angry about the Olympics, but that they just were a thing that was happening. Students weren't really going to do much about them at all.
Were most people more for or against the Olympics in general?
Well, you'd find about 45% in general were for the Olympics being here, with maybe about 20% saying that they don't care at all, 17% saying they're against them, and maybe about 19% saying they're sort of conflicted. But good percentage of students, even if they were for them being here, had some concerns about the Olympics as well. You know, most students agreed that, like, there would be a bad ecological impact from the games, and a good number also sort of felt that the economic impact or the social impact was mixed or not so good. So you find a sort of diverse set of opinions when you were talking to students as well.
Fair enough. So I know one complaint that people were talking about is not being informed well enough about the Olympics. What did you find people complain about the most?
Well, 45 or so percent of students said they got very little or no information regarding their rights, bus changes, where events were happening, so on and so forth. And there was sort of most didn't say that this was because they didn't care so much as that either they received information but they supposed didn't read into it enough, or it was just not communicated to them at all. A lot of people that even said that they had received a lot of information also said it was not through VanOck or the university, but through anti-Olympics networks. And this is coming from people that were more biased against the Olympics, but they said they really were informed about the Olympics not because of the planning committees, but because they didn't like the Olympics and they wanted to get informed about it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And so thank you guys very much for all that coverage. It's really interesting to hear what's going on with UBC students in terms of the games. As UBC students, I want to ask you, how do you feel going down and reporting about these games? Obviously, as you said, we have these 2 weeks off, so this is an opportunity for us to offer our full attention to what's going on. And I'm here with Paul Bucci and Trevor Record, who both have had access to the BC Media Center. And it's this facility that international and national media are using in order to access press releases and just resources to facilitate our reporting and our coverage. To my understanding, the UBC is working on a documentary about the ways in which students are reporting about the games. Is that correct?
That's totally correct, yeah. We're putting together basically an inside look at how our newsroom is going to be operating during these games. It was a suggestion, actually, from a reporter at the Globe and Mail, and we decided to take it as kind of a way to stretch the bounds of what we can do with storytelling. And we're going to be talking about everything we do during the Olympics, hopefully the amount of interaction we have with the protesters and with other students, and our interactions with major media outlets. Some of our editors are actually working for major media outlets as well, so we've got really at people at all levels, from completely uninvolved to as involved as students could possibly be.
Right. And so maybe you guys could touch on as well with the opening ceremony's protest. There was, you know, a great moment when many of the journalists were at the front at the barricades between the police and the protesters, and the protesters actually asked that all the journalists leave so that they could facilitate any type of activity that was to... what they precipitated activities that would be... yeah, of consequence if journalists got involved. How do you feel about that as official? You know, you look like students, you're young, you're going down there. Is there a type of respect given to that, or what do you think the sentiment is towards journalists during the games here?
Depends who you're talking to. Actually, we did have one journalist, Michael Thibault, who's one of those guys that really gets in the thick of things. I think he's actually had some problems from both police and protesters in the past. In fact, I think there was one protest he went to, which he got basically abused by some of the protesters. Even so, definitely it's a strange world for especially photojournalists in the thick of things. They're trying to get the best angle and get a sort of shot that will tell the story, but at the same time they're dealing with potential abuse and a lot of just movement and confusion. So,
which is a big deal when you have, you know, $3,000 to $6,000 of equipment on your body. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, what can we expect in the next few days from the Embassy? I know that you guys are you're big users of social media, so Facebook, Twitter, things like that. If somebody's really interested in your coverage, how could they get involved with that, or how could they find out?
Yeah, they can check us out on our website at ubyssey.ca or Twitter/UBC. On Facebook, we have a Facebook group. Just search the UBC. We've got a full-time multimedia editor and a full-time culture editor actually doing multimedia work as well. So we're going to have video. We're going to have Twitter. We've got probably 10 people downtown at all times just because this is a lot of fun for us to check out. So, any way that you can access news, we will be there trying to give you that news.
Great. Well, thank you guys very much for joining me in studio. I really appreciate your comments, and I look forward to getting updated from you again 1 week today. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we're going to be speaking with reporter Kate Hughes, who's in Whistler, who's going to have us some comments about what's happening there. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Our podcast update number one.
Work has begun on Canada's Information Highway. That's the state-of-the-art network that we're told will change everything from the way we do business to the way we learn. Without getting too technical, tell me how what you're working on is different from what's available to me right now.
So right now, if you want to listen to your favorite CITR program, you need to be listening to it on your radio live or streaming over the internet live. But with CITR podcasts, you'll be able to download your favorite show and listen to it whenever you want, on your computer or on your MP3 player.
I'm just thinking about that.
I know, it's pretty rad.
For more information, visit CITR.ca/podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be kind to robots.
CITR News is committed to bringing you in-depth Olympics coverage from an alternative perspective. Coming to you live Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m., we will bring you coverage of the games, bringing you stories and interviews that the corporate media cannot and will not offer you. From the anti-Olympic convergence to the supposed sustainability of the games, we will also be bringing you news updates every day during the games at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. Tune in Mondays and Fridays for an hour of CITR News on 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts available online at CITR.ca.
CITR News is committed to providing you with in-depth Olympic coverage from an alternative perspective. As part of this coverage, we are launching a new Eyes on the Street feature, where Vancouverites will have a chance to tell their Olympic story. We want to hear your perspective on life in Vancouver during the Games. That's why we're inviting you to be CITR's Eyes on the Street this February. If you're at an event, a protest, a celebration, or even simply on the bus, tell us about it. There are three ways to file a report. Call our Eyes on the Street hotline at 604-822-5334. Email news at CITR.ca or tweet CITR News. Then sit back and wait for your report to be featured on the next edition of News 101, which airs Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey everyone, you're listening to News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, reporting live from Vancouver at the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. On the line, I have Kate Hughes, one of our newsies here at the station, who's actually in Whistler right now, and Kate's going to be able to tell us about the atmosphere. Kate, how do you think everything's going down there? Are you having a good time?
Yeah, it's actually brilliant, to be honest, Brad. The atmosphere is brilliant. There are so many people here who are just enjoying themselves. People have come off the slopes now, and we're just in Whistler Village. The pubs are full. The Olympics are being shown on live screens throughout the village. And, yeah, the village is buzzing, to be honest. Yeah, it's great.
And so, obviously, there's a lot of international media, a lot of Vancouverites who might have gone up for the Games, a lot of students. Yeah. Have you noticed any protesters? Or are there any people there visibly dissenting?
To be honest, today I've not seen anything in that sort of nature at all. The impression that I've got is that Whistler, the people here are kind of trying to move, I don't know, they aren't really concentrating on the negative impacts of the Olympics, and it seems that everyone is extremely positive, and there are many positive reactions towards the Olympics, so I have not seen anything today of that sort of nature. I have seen a lot of police about on the slopes today. You have there are policemen on skis, so there are official people about who are clearly watching out for that sort of thing, but I've not seen anything today at all.
And Kate, you're with right now an international guest. And so, George, if you could pass the phone off to him, maybe he could tell us about what the atmosphere of being a tourist at the Games.
Sure, I'll just pass it over now. Hang on.
Hi, Brad.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Not bad, how are you?
Can you tell us about what's your opinion about the atmosphere in Whistler in terms of being an international guest in Whistler while the Games are, you know, going on and everyone's really encouraged that Canada's finally got that gold medal?
Well, being an international person here is absolutely fantastic. Like, everyone's got a million different flags around. I mean, we're watching the men's downhill today, and I was stood with a group of about 10 other British people, along with a group of Americans, and of course a bunch of Canadians, as always. And it's just a really good kind of vibrant atmosphere, international people everywhere. It's great, yeah.
And could you give us your opinion about the protesting here in Vancouver? Do you think has that affected Whistler in any way? Do you think that the violent protest that happened on Saturday has sent any type of ripple to Whistler?
Well, to be honest, like, I get the impression that Whistler is quite an artificial place anyway. Like, it's, I don't know, like, I think they've glossed over a lot of the problems they're facing here, maybe. And like Kate said, there's a massive security presence here with police on the slopes and things like that. So, yeah, I don't think that we're seeing the same kind of protests here in Whistler, to be honest.
Right.
Because of the nature of the place itself.
And how do you feel? Do you feel at all restricted, or do you feel that there's just is it grossly overpriced? Anything in that way?
I think the prices have gone up, especially in the bars and the restaurants and things like that. I think the only thing I'd say about being restricted is that today on the slopes there was hardly anybody about. I mean, we didn't wait more than 2 minutes for a lift, which in the middle of the Winter Olympics is absolutely incredible, really, to me. I think that's because of the vehicle permits that you need to drive up from Vancouver at the moment. The only way to get up is on the bus, which is kind of pricing a lot of normal Vancouver people out of the trip up here. So I think that's the only thing I'd say against the Olympics at the moment in Whistler.
Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, and have a good time in the rest of the night.
No problem. Thanks very much, Brad.
That was reporter Kate Hughes and George, her international guest, in Whistler today, speaking about the atmosphere. We're going to turn now to a piece that's been reappearing across the country. As you heard here, we had the UBC reporters in the station, and at CITR, we're proud to work alongside with many different partner publications and partner media sources, as well as CJSF, the SFU radio station, and the UBC, the campus paper here. However, in Vancouver, there's the Vancouver Media Co-op, which is just a coalition of people who are providing an alternative perspective of the Games. And one of their reporters, Frank, actually produced this piece that we're going to air about what's happened this past weekend. And this piece was actually picked up by Democracy Now!, a news program that is produced in New York that focuses on what's happening in the world from an alternative perspective as well. So I'm just going to play this piece, and then afterwards we'll be able to go into depth as to the implications of what Frank has gone into here.
A historic mobilization in Vancouver against the 2010 Winter Olympics has pushed back hard against the International Olympic Committee, and the $6 billion sporting event. People of all political persuasions joined together to reject the Olympic industry, holding conferences, marches, and carrying out direct actions aimed at undermining the image of the Olympics. An image, critics say, obscures the negative social and environmental impacts the Games bring with them. The primary slogan of the resistance movement is "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land," referring to the immoral and illegal occupation of indigenous lands by settlers. After years of organizing and mobilization, the anti-Olympics convergence got underway in Vancouver this weekend. Following dozens of protests and disruptions across Canada, the Olympic torch was blocked from passing through Vancouver's downtown east side. Here's Melissa Elliott of Six Nations explaining why they blocked the torch.
With these 2010 Olympics, VanOck and the IOC, in partnership with Canada, is trying to create a false illusion. They're creating a false illusion that Canada is good and has positive relations with our people. But we are here to break this illusion, to tell the truth, by declaring the following. We are not Canadian. We are not a defeated people. This land was never surrendered. Our nations and our people still exist and will continue to exist.
No Olympics on stolen native land!
Next, residents of Commercial Drive, a historically progressive street, showed their collective resistance to the torch and what it represents.
Our streets! Our streets!
The people at Victory Square reportedly chased the torch as it continued to move. At least it's on its way down Hastings.
Hip-hop artist Testament was present to lend his support.
All right, well, we're here today because there's been a call out by people of this community to stop the torch coming through Commercial Drive. Many of my friends live in the neighborhood, so it's a great place, so we want to avoid having the Olympics come through with their bullshit RBC and their bullshit Coke propaganda. They're bullshit like Canadian flags, and we want to reclaim this neighborhood. So that's what people are doing. We're taking the streets, we're taking this over, we're blocking the torch, and we're gonna stand here, we're gonna stay here, we're gonna like occupy the intersections and force them to reroute it.
Even the disrupted torchbearer, Carrie Zaretnik, could empathize with protesters whose cause continued to gain support as the games drew nearer.
I think it's great for people to have free speech, and I saluted some of my friends that are there, but I'm a national team athlete, and I was, and I'm in love with the Olympics, and I think the spirit has really uplifted our country in a better way than just complaining.
The torchbearer was loaded into a police car, a fitting symbol of the $1 billion spent on police, military, and private security during the Olympic Games. Event of the day was a family-friendly rally and march titled Take Back Our City, organized by a coalition of groups called the 2010 Welcoming Committee. The evening brought out at least 3,000 protesters representing activists of all stripes, including indigenous sovereigntists and supporters, migrant justice and environmental justice groups, anti-poverty groups, queer rights organizations, and more. Harjab Graywall of the Olympic Resistance Network commented on the success of the mobilization.
We know the Olympics suck. What's more important is this resistance. What's more important is that I'm absolutely ecstatic that all of us today are going to take to the streets and give them a hit like they've never had before. The IOC didn't know what was coming, but we're here now, and that's party.
Well, we're going to take to the streets today. We're going to do this because people said we couldn't do it. People said you couldn't have an amplified voice like this one. People said you couldn't have protest signs like these ones. And people said you couldn't go outside of a designated protest area. Well, the world is my designated protest area.
That was Garth Mullins, an anti-Olympic organizer from Vancouver. As darkness fell, demonstrators marched towards BC Place, where the opening ceremonies for the games were taking place. Saturday morning, anti-capitalist activists took Georgia Street in downtown Vancouver in an action designed to block Olympic traffic from Vancouver to the resort town of Whistler. The action was billed as a heart attack set to clog the arteries of capitalism. A brass band accompanied marchers who carried banners, shouted slogans, and advanced through the streets of downtown. After blocking the street with dumpsters and paper boxes, a small contingency broke away from the crowd and smashed the windows of the Bay, a company with direct ties to Canada's colonial past and an Olympic sponsor. Longtime Vancouver resident Maxim Winther explains.
If you look at the stores and the industries that had their windows smashed, if you actually look at their history of what they've done, the Hudson's Bay Company, exactly, it was the original government of this land who was instrumental in bringing smallpox to the local people and, you know, policing the fur trade and, you know, the genocide that happened. Something like 90% of the people that lived here were taken out. And so Hudson's Bay has a hand in that.
Saturday's actions were met with harsh violence coming from police, who beat demonstrators in the street, kettled another group, and arrested 13. On Sunday, an estimated 5,000 people turned out for the 19th annual Women's Memorial March to honor missing and murdered women from Vancouver's downtown east side. This event, led by Indigenous women, was not an Olympic protest, but all activists were invited to stand beside them. More actions are planned for Monday, when homelessness activists will erect a tent city and an anti-war rally will highlight Canada's military presence in Afghanistan.
That was a video that's actually produced by the Vancouver Media Co-op and made available today. I spoke earlier with the man who produced it, Frank, the journalist who produced this piece, about the implications of posting that video onto YouTube and what happened after that. On the line, I have Frank, who's working with the Media Co-op. And Frank, you present, or you you compiled a report about the beginning of the Olympic Games. And can you tell us a little bit about what that story was, what you produced?
Yeah, I mean, first up, I should say that we are an independent media center comprised of over 40 independent media activists from all over the world who converge here to cover the Olympic resistance and to actually cover that angle of the resistance. And our mission has been from the very beginning to give these folks a voice. We've had over a dozen videographers down on the streets, and we've compiled over 3 terabytes of video over the weekend, and we just went through some of the best footage, and we basically created a roundup that showed what the resistance did over the weekend.
And so you compiled that report, as you said, and made it into a really great piece. And then that piece was actually picked up by Democracy Now!, am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was broadcast on this morning's show.
And most recently, you uploaded that onto YouTube. And what happened there?
I wasn't thinking anything about it. I put it up, and then I tweeted it. And I noticed when I went back that there was only one view on it. And since our website has been getting slammed, we got over 1 million hits over the weekend. I was a little distraught. And then one of my friends, one of our colleagues said that we have been, that our video was blocked by the IOC. And I had to go to a different computer to actually see it. And then I went 2 or 3 computers, and my disbelief, there it was. We took a screen grab of it, and we reposted the video on Blit TV. And so far, they have not taken it down from Blit TV.
And so what are the implications about that? What do you think, was there really inflammatory content that the IOC would have been kind of trying to shelter the public's view from? What motivated them, do you think, to take down this content?
The IOC has just been constantly trying to protect their brand at all costs. That's why they forced the Vancouver City Council to pass those laws that basically made having anti-Olympic signs around Olympic venues illegal. And so this is just the latest. They know that there's a strong resistance out there and that uses their own logos in the form of a parody and they don't like that to be out there. We put a dent on their image, and they want to stop it at all costs.
Right. And so what's next? Do you think is this kind of discouraging or encouraging?
Well, it's encouraging because it means that our media is getting out there and that they're threatened by us. If you know, I've been doing video mashups for years. I've had videos that have been seen by millions of people, and I never gotten a takedown notice for copyright infringement. This is the very, very first time, and it's actually very encouraging that this is actually happening.
And so if people are interested, how can they see what you're going to produce next?
They should go to vancouver.mediacoop.ca. Again, vancouver.mediacoop.ca. And also, if they can report street news from the street on our website called 2010.mediacoop.ca. Again, that's 2010.mediacoop.ca. And that's an aggregator website where people can tweet. They can actually put reports on the website. They can peg pins in a map of where different things are happening on the map, and it was something that was successfully used during the G20 in Pittsburgh last year.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and best of luck in the coming 10 days.
All right, thank you very much.
That was a story about a piece produced by the Vancouver Media Co-op that was flagged by the IOC and removed from YouTube. If you want to check that out, we played that earlier, but if you want to check out the video for it, please do check out the Vancouver Media Co-op website. We're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll have more coverage about the Valentine's Day March in the downtown east side. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Making a cuppa. Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy, too.
A student's life often follows a pattern. Eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey everyone, welcome back and thanks for being with me. I'm Brad Pepink and I'm bringing you some Olympics coverage here at News 101 at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. As Frank made mention earlier, yesterday was the 19th annual Valentine's Day March to commemorate the missing women of the downtown east side. I was at the protest and I was at the march and I spoke with some participants about the significance of the march. Here's what a few of them had to say. All right, I'm at Cordova and Main Street with
Juanita.
Thanks, Juanita. And so I was just wondering, can you tell us what's going on right now?
This is the 19th annual Missing Women's Memorial March.
And what's the memorial for?
The memorial is for to honor the missing and murdered women, who've been impacted by violence in the downtown east side.
Okay.
So this is to really honor and bring light, to the atrocities, what's happened,
right.
to the women in this community. And it started 19 years ago when the community was outraged, over a violent death of a First Nations woman. And so we don't really speak of her name today, in memory of her family.
Okay.
But so we're here today just to really honor.
Okay.
Right?
And how do you think it's going? What kind of activities is the march kind of starting with? I guess it started with some speeches earlier today, and now there's a procession.
They were more the family sharing around their hardships, grievances, struggles. Also, for people to come together and show community, right? Support. And we I mean, I...
Oh, okay.
I don't speak for everybody.
Right.
I just, you know, share, like, my own version, right?
And so what motivates you to come down here today?
I knew over half the women who've gone missing from the Picton trial.
Right.
And I believe that I myself would have been a victim if I didn't get clean and sober. And I now work in the community.
So I'm on Alexander Street with...
Gladys Raddick.
Hi, Gladys. Thanks for speaking with me. I was wondering if you could just tell us about your motivations for coming down and participating in the march today.
I have a niece that's missing from the Highway of Tears. I'm the co-founder of Walk for Justice.
Could you tell us what that is?
Walk for Justice is a nonprofit organization. We walk for justice. We walk from Vancouver to Ottawa. In the summer of 2008, we walked from Vancouver to Prince Rupert. In 2009, we're planning up another walk from Kamloops to cover the rest of the Highway of Tears. On June 21st, we'll be leaving Kamloops to Winnipeg.
And can you clarify the Highway of Tears for our listeners?
The Highway of Tears is a stretch of highway between Prince Rupert, Prince George, that leads over to Winnipeg. It's Highway 16 in northern BC, and at this time, the RCMP have 18 on their list. I have 44 that are missing or murdered on that particular highway. My niece, Tamara Lynn Chipman, went missing on September the 21st, 2005, and she still hasn't been found. She left behind a little 2.5-year-old boy who now doesn't remember who she is. He's going on 6 now, and it's really sad that it has come to that. And the thing is, this little boy is going to be, in 5 years from now, he's going to be asking where his mother is and what was done about it.
Right.
And we want answers.
Right.
That's what we want.
And so participating in this march, do you think that your voice will be heard kind of to a greater extent? Is this an issue that Vancouverites don't necessarily hear a lot about?
That's right, and that was the whole idea behind this year's march, was because we want the world to know that this is one of Canada's dirtiest secrets here, where we've got too many missing and murdered women with no accountability.
Well, thank you so much, Linda.
Have a great day.
I was just wondering what motivated you to take part in this march today.
Well, I'm really concerned about the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. I think this is part of all of us paying tribute to this and to honoring those women and to giving to part of saying how important that we think it is to protect Aboriginal women and all women against violence. Okay. And so I'm here to try to honor that.
Great. So I'm on the corner of Cordova and Corral, and I'm here with Carrie. Carrie, can you tell us a little bit about what motivated you to come down to the march today?
Well, I work as a social worker in Vancouver, and a lot of my clients are First Nations, and they live in the Downtown East Side. And so just through speaking with them and hearing about their lives, it's really apparent to me the devastation on the First Nations community in the Downtown East Side and the difficulty. The issue of sex work, you know, some people are for it, some people think, you know, saying that it should be decriminalized, some people think that it's, you know, always prostitution, which never happened, it's a very contentious thing, but I've seen just how difficult it is for people in, like, their personal lives on a day-to-day basis and within families, and given the history here, not just with Picton, but also with missing women, you know, currently not all around Canada and the States. It's a very important issue, and it's something that I think it's important for the communities who coalesce around.
And can you tell us maybe a little bit about the atmosphere? Obviously, it's a very interesting time in Vancouver, the Olympics going on right now, and yesterday there was quite a bit of violent protest in the city. This seems to be a very peaceful protest, or not even a protest, just a commemorative march. Do you think that's really what is kind of, does that epitomize the sentiment of what's going on?
Yeah, this is very intentionally not a protest. It is a memorial march. With all the planning, it was a big issue in surrounding the build-up to the Olympics, that the march would get to be held, that the route wouldn't be changed. It's a very intentional route, you know, because it goes along a lot of spots that are important in terms of the missing women. And so it was, and also very consciously, people were asked that the First Nations elder women would still get to lead it, that it wouldn't be co-opted by other groups, that it would remain true to the, you know, all the years past, and that it's meant to be a memorial about these women, about these issues. And it seems like everybody has been true to that sentiment. You don't see signs, you don't see people yelling other slogans. Everybody is super peaceful, super respectful.
I also had the chance to catch up with Mayor Gregor Robertson, who was on his way to the protest, and I asked him his sentiments about participating in the march and just kind of what was happening in Vancouver on Sunday, Valentine's Day.
So I'm on Hastings Street with Mayor Robertson, and Mayor Robertson, I was wondering, were you taking part in the march today?
I'm just headed to the last part of it right now at Oppenheimer Park.
Okay, and so are you in support of what this group is trying to accomplish today?
Well, I think it's critical that there's a lot more support and certainly a judicial inquiry into the missing women and figure out exactly what has happened here. And I know the community's been calling for years. Some of us electeds have been calling for years, and hopefully there will be change and there will be justice.
Right. And so, obviously, this is a very important event as it's the 19th annual taking place during the Olympics. Is there any way in which the city was trying to coordinate for this to get a bit more attention?
Yeah, it's difficult this year with all the things happening. Today is the busiest day probably in the city's history.
Right.
But we managed to move things around and have the Lunar New Year parade and have the Missing Women's March happen in the midst of all the Olympics activities and hundreds of thousands of visitors that are in the city. And I think it's been a great day.
Right. And can you comment on the protest that happened yesterday, where around 150 violent and militant protesters began vandalizing downtown Vancouver? Do you have any comment?
Well, it's really disappointing that it turned into ugly stuff, vandalizing and people totally disrespectful of others on the street and the city itself. And there's important issues to raise, important concerns that need to be voiced. We see today with thousands of people marching for the missing women that it happens respectfully and peacefully, but it's powerful. And that's the way things should be done.
Right.
Voices get heard, but with respect.
And so you're very much in support of people voicing their opinions throughout the Olympics, but just not in this manner?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's been lots of good, constructive protest in the last number of days, and the world notices that. It's just unfortunate when it gets violent and disrespectful, and then that's where the attention goes. The attention goes into vandalism and stupidity instead of the issues that we want to raise.
Right. And lastly, can you comment on the widespread appearance of the BCCLA legal observers? Is this encouraging to you, or is this kind of demonstrating a bit of hostility in Vancouver?
No, I think it's good. I think having citizen observers is totally fine and reasonable. You know, everyone needs to keep an eye out and make sure that civil liberties are being respected. And this is you know, we have the largest domestic security operation in history happening here with the Olympic Games.
Right.
And lots of people from the military and from police outside of the city that, you know, that may not know exactly how we do things here.
Right.
And I'm hopeful that they all are respectful of our city and the people's rights to take action and protest as needed, as they want to.
Right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today. Best of luck in the next 12 days.
Thank you. Cheers. You're totally welcome.
All right.
I also had the chance to speak with a visual artist about the what's happening in Vancouver with the Games and the ways in which different people are negotiating that type of interruption to the city. She was speaking as a participant of the march yesterday.
So I'm here with Rena, and Rena, can you tell me about this program called Bright Lights, and how is it connected to what's going on today with the Downtown East Side?
Well, it's actually a collection of light and media-based installations and performances that are happening in and around the Lower East Side. There are a lot of arts organizations in this neighborhood, and the focus, from my understanding, was to deal with the context and talk about things that are going on in the Lower East Side. So I came down to video this for my project called We Are Watching at the Jeffrey Boone Gallery, and the idea there was to create images or allow people to create video images to be projected onto the building in public space of their ideas of how to package and present the city and the Olympics. So I develop the platform, and then people bring me, give me the content through email. So the idea is to send it by the cell phones, and then it goes up almost immediately. However, up until the first day, it was all torch relay, so obviously it was after the fact. But that's pretty much what my project is about.
Interesting. So can you tell us maybe about the kind of your intention about the way that you say you're packaging, the way in which people kind of represent the city? Does that have a lot to do with public space and how we interact with that?
Yeah. Basically, I'm using the controls of public space because the large projection, participatory projection, is only one aspect of the piece. Then the people that are watching the projection are under surveillance, and then that surveillance goes into the gallery and is projected into the gallery. So it's basically about gallery viewers watching people watching a projection, watching the Olympics, people watching the Olympics. So it's about how we're being asked to watch. So the Olympics wants us to watch in one particular way, and I'm sort of trying to tease out all of the other things that are going on underneath in terms of controls, the controls of public space, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do, and how it actually, the conditions which this entire sort of machine has created.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciated that. I'm studying art history.
And that's our show for February the 15th, 2010. I'm Brad Pepink, and this is News 101. I really appreciate everyone listening, and I want to encourage you to take part in our ongoing coverage of the Olympic Games. We're going to be releasing a 5-minute headlines every day of the week during the Olympics, and you can hear that here at CITR at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m., as well as rebroadcast on our partner stations across the country, and we look forward to them being able to play those pieces. Also, please follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, or just send us an email. It's news@citr.ca, or you can leave us a message at 604-822-5334. Again, this is Brad Pepink, and I want to thank you guys for listening. Hope you enjoy the rest of the games.